Welcome to the seminar series, Interactions Between Clients and Professionals, hosted by Cesar. In this podcast, Cesar's doctoral students speak with internationally recognized scholars in social work and interview them about their personal journey toward becoming a scholar in social work. I ask them about contributions, challenges, and regrets. In this episode, Sivangar Rosberg interviews Karen Healy, who joins all the way from Australia.
Hi, Karen.
Hello. Hello, Sivan.
Hi. Thank you for being here. And it's great that we have Zoom so we can do this from the other side of the world.
Exactly. Yeah.
So can we just dive in? Is it okay? Mm-hmm.
With you? Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. So in your work, you focus a lot on vulnerable children and vulnerable families in the fields of social work and social policy. So I was hoping you can tell us a little bit about why you chose those areas and where do you think you have your biggest contribution?
Okay. Thank you. And thank you for all the comments so far. Do tell me if I'm speaking too quickly because I know I have a strong accent, Australian accent. I actually see my contributions in several ways. I would say one of my biggest contributions is around the conceptualization of social work more generally. So the text to which Sven referred, trying to understand the dynamic nature of social work, and trying to articulate that dynamism in a way that makes sense over time. And so for me, when I graduated as a new social worker, my school had been very radical, a radical social work school in Australia. And that was in many ways a good foundation for critical thinking. But I was working, first of all, I worked in a school. I worked in educational social work. I just did a short-term role there. And then I worked in health. And then I worked in child protection. And it really struck me how my purpose, my context, the language being used changed so much in each context and how that shaped the construction of my role. And it really left me quite... really quite interested in the social construction of social work and clients, our possibilities for action. And that's what I tried to articulate in that book, because I was very concerned that social workers left the university only having really spoken to each other about what social work is. And yet there were these other very powerful discourses shaping our work. And I heard that your interest is in autism spectrum disorder. Okay. And it's so important, I think, that we understand the ways in which biomedical discourse shapes the understanding of such conditions. Citizen rights groups shape it differently. Different groups are shaping it in different ways. And usually these other groups see themselves as having the truth. And I think we really make a mistake if we go in thinking we have the truth too. And instead being able to read these different truths can be very powerful for providing options for practice. So that was very interesting to me. And I also became very interested in how these ideas changed over time. And the example that I gave years ago at a seminar with Sven is that I have a brother who's only a year younger than me, and he's always had a lot of psychological troubles. But because I was a child born in the 60s, I remember my parents would take him to doctors and they'd say, "There's something wrong with this boy." And they would say, "He's a normal boy. He's just a normal boy, Mrs. Healy," to my mother and to my father. And these days, for sure, he would be diagnosed with ADHD or autism or something. And now I'm not sure if it would help or not, but I have such a strong memory as a child of my parents trying to find a diagnosis that wasn't, the biomedical discourse just wasn't dominant at that time. So it made me reflect also on my life and whether, you know, these discourses help or don't help. But for me, it's that framework still of thinking about the different truths, different professions, different institutions bring. And I think that is, for me, that's a very important part of my contribution. Mm. If we turn then to a second aspect, which you've highlighted, the vulnerable children and families, and the paper you're looking at today, I believe that families remain important to people across their life course, and that in many countries, certainly in places like Australia that are more liberal welfare states than your own, the state relies heavily on the family at all points in the life course. And yet what we do to these vulnerable children is we remove them from that family support, or even and we remove them from their extended family. Then when they turn 18 or 21, we say, okay, you can go back to that family. And nothing's changed. Mm. And so I'm very interested in the concept of recognising what capacity there is in families and nurturing that, while recognising some families you are not safe for full-time care. It doesn't mean they can't have a role. And I've made, I feel, important contributions there by not only my writing but being part of the policy process. And then the other area I've made some contributions is around teaching, really trying to prepare students for the realities of practice. So I've become very engaged in simulation. We do, for example, today I was teaching students family group meeting processes, how you facilitate the voices of children and parents, how child protection workers can do their work well. So there's some of the areas of my contribution.
Okay, thank you. You've written several books focusing on social work practices as well.
Yes.
So in those books you provide knowledge to the readers about, for example, improving communication skills and writing skills for social workers. So I wanted to ask you, how do you see the connection between social work practice and social work research? And what do you think we're doing right and what needs to be improved there?
Well, firstly, I feel that the practice base of social work has not been very well articulated. And so it has been part of my life's work to want to contribute to people being better prepared for practice. I certainly felt, coming through a very radical school of social work, that I was well prepared theoretically. But for example, I didn't know how to do the most basic genogram or an eco map or anything like that when I finished my degree. And I learned all those things at work, which, you know, you can do that. But I feel that I'm trying to balance up the social work education process a bit more so that people who graduate can say, I have some skills that I can identify. And so they can be communication skills. So the communication book was born a lot out of how do you manage very difficult communication situations that in some contexts social workers deal with every day, like a child protection or a mental health social worker will every day experience someone in distress or anger or some despair. And I feel having some skills about how to centre yourself in that, communicate in that, is important. And also, as you know, I've done some work on written communication because, again, looking at when communication is taught, it's generally taught only about the spoken aspects and the nonverbal. And yet, research on social work practice shows that about 50% of social workers' time is spent in writing. Now, whether that's a good thing or not, I'm not sure, but social workers need to be able to be really good at case notes and reports. And for me, it's about people being self-confident in their skill base and being the best advocates they can be. Yeah, and then your question about social work research. I'm quite troubled by social work research. In Australia, we have something called the Research Excellence Exercise, and all of the universities have to put forward their best research in their different fields. And around 50% of the universities offering social work do not even participate in that exercise for social work, because the quality of the social work research just isn't good enough to compete in that space. So I hope that into the future, I hope social workers will take control of that space, because I think if we don't, other social scientists just will and are. So sometimes I work a lot with sociologists, and I think ideally we should have a pathway for social workers to maybe do a sort of sociology major where they learn all those social research skills, if that's the direction they want to go in. Does that,
I'm just wondering, where is it that you think we are doing it right, or where do you think things should remain the way they are?
What I think social work is doing right is that I think we do focus on the citizens' needs, that I think we are very committed to understanding and supporting people who are vulnerable to be heard. I think that's one thing social workers are doing right. I think also social workers really are very good generally at the grey areas. So living with uncertainty compared to other professional groups, and also the informal care system. So I think social workers working in the space of family and community, but particularly family, I think we're doing that. Right.
So to follow up on this question, what do you think are the main area of responsibility of social work research? And what do you think, so in other words, what is social work to you?
That's a big question. Social work is about the interface between the individual and their society, and improving the situation for individuals by both building that person's capacity, changing the way society looks at that person and being respectful of the person's journeys, and also hopefully creating better social systems. So I really want the students I work with to understand the history of social work, the things that we've done wrong as well as the things we've done right. I want students, I want the students I work with and my colleagues to really understand the impact of social disadvantage and social marginalisation on people's opportunities, and to be effective advocates for vulnerable people. Mm. And if I could just give it, I think, quite a simple example, I'm sure you'd have examples like this in Sweden, is that recently in Australia we had a young boy who died as a result of his stepfather's actions. And a lot of people around me in my personal life and so forth were saying those parents should be, you know, jailed for, you know, forever for what they did to that child. And then there were public reports about what had happened, and I just read them, whereas a lot of people hadn't. And I said, you do know that the mother herself was a victim of child abuse, that her own parents actually had gone to jail for what they had done to her, that she had five children, she was living in a garage at the time this happened. And then, you know, and I just pointed out some facts, and people going, oh, okay, you know, okay, I see it differently, you know. And I'm not trying to hit people over the head. I think we need to be articulate about the social context so other people can decide, if they know that, do they still hold that same view?
Yeah, I'm thinking that when I was working as a social worker before I started this, when you enter families' lives, when you enter families' homes and you see these daily struggles and these difficult experiences, you develop this different type of empathy, I guess, and understanding that it's not black and white. So, for today, we've read your article, Recognizing the Caring Capabilities of Birth Families of Removed Children Towards a Critical Policy Agenda, on how the neoliberal state undermines the caring capabilities of vulnerable families. And I thought it was fascinating to read. I wanted to ask you to say something on how you see the possible influence of children and families' participation in decision-making on a policy level, policies that are relevant for their lives, and also maybe your thoughts on same families and children participation in social work research.
Well, firstly, when I think of children and family participation, the first thing I think of is actually participation at the policy level, that I think it's very important that children and parents, I'll say parents at the moment, have a place at the decision-making table about how our laws and policies are structured. And I have been very, I guess, fortunate that I'm linked to a parent advocacy group here in where I live in my city. And I chair a council of parents speaking to our minister, like our government minister, about their lives and what would help them. And I think it's very powerful for our leaders, you know, in both government and then as politicians, to hear directly from the parents' voice and or voices. And similar, and for many of these parents, they often cry at these meetings. They become very emotional because no one's ever listened to them before. That they've always been treated as the sort of the marginal people in society, and to be there speaking to the minister and the minister acknowledging them is so powerful. So I think this is important. And in our, because of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, actually in our child protection legislation, children, there's a children's group that has a right to be at the policy-making table. I think parents are much more maligned. They're in the child protection system, they're seen as the perpetrators. And unpacking that, challenging that view of them is very important. So that's the first, and what they ask for are things like access to good housing, access to trauma recovery services, access to drug and alcohol services, access to parenting support. So being able to ask that directly is very important. And then within family group conferences and family group meetings, I think they're very important for enabling parents and their broader family and children to articulate what would make a difference for them. I worry that those processes become a bit corrupted. In Australia, at least, we don't have private time, for example, in the family meeting. So the original ideas that were there are not always followed. So that worries me. But I think when parents and broader family and children have a voice, they give really important insights into what different system they want. And, that can make a big difference.
I was wondering also regarding social work research, but before that, I know that there is a lot of tension with Aboriginal communities in Australia. I'm wondering if you can say something about that in a social work perspective.
Yes, it's very, I am actually doing a project that is about Indigenous and non-Indigenous children's experience of our out-of-home care system. And so we work with Indigenous agencies and non-Indigenous agencies. And it's a very tense situation because the history is so terrible of in Australia with respect to the removal of children as an act of genocide, and that was to try to breed out the Aboriginality out of these children. And most of those children ended up in very abusive situations, very high rates of suicide, very high rates of other serious problems in their lives. And that was a direct result of white intervention. And we now, I mean, social work and all the other helping professions, yeah, has that history of having been aligned with that. And we have to just be so respectful of the harm that has been done. And trying to work with, I think, for the big issue for Indigenous people is whether the systems we have can ever work for Indigenous communities. So one of the tensions that we have in our project's looking at what is the experience of these children as they go through out-of-home care, foster care, kinship care and so forth. And some of our Indigenous partners just say, we don't want an out-of-home care system. We want a system that keeps these families together, keeps children on country with family. But on the other hand, the reality is in Australia we've got 18,000 Indigenous children in foster or kinship care. So do we try and make the system better for those children, or do we work on dismantling this system? And then they're the sort of conversations that we have.
Because there is this fundamental issue of what is a family that changes from these communities and perhaps how the state sees a family.
That's right. I guess the issue, one of the issues though, is the concept of the parent as well. It's true for, particularly for Indigenous people, often aunties and uncles and grandparents are considered core parents. I think in our child protection system, we focus a lot on parents as the primary carer, and it can stop us seeing other options within a family.
A little bit. Oh, yeah, and I wanted to know also what do you think of participation within social work, possible participation of children and vulnerable families in social work research before we move on to talking about the future?
Well, I think it's really important that children and parents and broader family members' voices are heard within research. I think it's also important for the researcher to be clear about what the purpose of the research is. And what I'm meaning by that is that things like participatory action research can put a lot of, they involve a big time commitment, and they may not necessarily be the best way for a parent or a child to have their voice heard. So it's really trying to work or think about what the purpose that you're trying to achieve with the group that you're working with and what is the best way of doing that. For example, I believe some really good statistical analyses remotely can sometimes be very important. For example, showing the number of Indigenous children in out-of-home care, the number of Indigenous children who aren't placed with country and community, and then showing the ongoing impact can be very important, both doing that quantitatively and qualitatively. Yeah. So I think the diversity of methods is important.
So towards the end of this, I have two more questions. What are the challenges for the discipline of social work? How do you see its future?
I wrote down some things about this. I think there's a few challenges. I'll start with one that you probably noticed in my introduction, and that was around the challenge of interprofessionalism. I think we are living in the age of interprofessionalism, and where all the professional groups, the boundaries, are supposed to drop. And you would have heard the title of my school. I'm in a school of nursing, midwifery and social work. And we're a discipline group within that school. And the idea was that we're supposed to all work together, which everyone's very caring and it's very good in that way, but the realities can be that the logic of a discipline group will dominate. So, for example, I was previously in a social and behavioural sciences faculty. We're now in a nursing, midwifery and social work school. And so there's a strong emphasis on having to talk about health outcomes, talking about our health and medical research and locating our research within that. So I think this concept of interprofessionalism is not innocent. It has all sorts of implications for us. And I actually think the implications for social work are potentially quite serious and negative. They can be positive too, but the negative ones are that social work is very relational. It's about those grey area aspects of the individual in their environment. And many of these other professions we're dealing with come from a much more scientific, traditional scientific tradition. And within the logic of the contemporary university, it would seem that that's the dominant idea, traditional scientific positivist logic. And the thinking is, well, once people get that, then they can do the relational stuff later. So I do feel that it can be difficult to say what our place is within that. Mm. And, and this sort of sense of not having a clear place within that and being the sort of junior partner within many interprofessional exchanges. So I think that's how do we manage that? And I think for a start, we maybe don't try and solve it, try and understand it first of all. Mm-hmm. And I think some things that social workers do really well within that are things like the citizen-led, you know, not trying to compete with other professions, instead saying, we're here to facilitate the voice of others, the voice of the child, the voice of the parent, the voice of the extended family. So I think there's some of the that's a big challenge. I think another challenge is the emergence of citizen-led groups within our various areas of practice and the question of whether you actually need professionally trained people in some of these areas and what is our role. And I think we have a facilitator role rather than being the advocates, enabling other people to advocate for themselves. So I see the potential for social work's role to change. And I finally think that we have to really continue to think about where we fit in relation to traditional scientific research, which I think is dominant and increasingly dominant within the university. Yeah.
So to finish off, if you can tell us a little bit of the personal challenges that you faced in your career.
Yes, okay. Well, I think one of the challenges I've faced is this concept of metrics. So while for me personally, my books, for example, and the papers I write are very well received, my citation count would be nothing compared to many psychologists, for example. And so within the university, sometimes going for grants and for promotion, being compared to traditional scientists can be a challenge. So that's been something of a challenge for me. I think for every social work academic within a research intensive university, what is our place within that and how do we talk about the contribution we make, which is often much more applied than many other professional groups. I think more recently some of the challenges I've faced have been around the interprofessional context and how I position my research, which is very within the critical social science tradition, in a health and nursing and midwifery context. I also have myself faced challenges around the fact that I want to make practical contributions. So I have taken on practical roles outside academia. So, for example, for 6 years I was the national president of our professional association, for Australian Association of Social Workers. Okay. I've often been at many public inquiries, and this sort of tension between being an academic and those academic outputs that you need and also wanting to make a practical contribution and the time that takes that's been a big, I don't know if it's an obstacle, but it's a major challenge for me. And I must say one thing I'm very proud of and happy about is that that contribution, a few years ago I was made a member of the Order of Australia, and it just felt like it was so good to have something about the practical contribution that I'd made rather than an academic contribution. So people who make contributions to making Australia a better society get these sort of medals from the governor. And it, to me, that's a real highlight of my career, that people put me forward for that. Because within the academic world, it was like, oh, okay, you're going to another meeting. Oh, you're on another board or something like that. You know, how much is that going to cost you in terms of publications? Mm. So that getting that balance right.
Thank you so much, Karen.